Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is this comforting expectation of precision, you know?
Absolutely.
It feels like engineering. You fall off your bike, your arm swells up, and they slide you into the X-ray machine.
Right. And the doctor just points to a jagged white line on a glowing screen and says, well, there it is. That's the problem.
Exactly. The problem is visible. It's neatly categorized. We can put a cast on it and track the healing on a calendar.
It's predictable.
But when you step into the landscape of human trauma, of deeply rooted emotional survival, actually how the mind processes unimaginable extremes, that X-ray machine breaks down completely.
It really does. The human consciousness simply refuses to process extreme existential threats or even the overwhelming relief of survival in clean clinical spreadsheets. It demands poetry. It demands mythology. When the psyche is pushed to the absolute brink, it begins to speak in the language of surrealism, manifesting our deepest fears and, our most profound hopes as tangible physical environments.
And that is exactly the surreal, completely uncharted landscape we are navigating today. Welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks. I'm excited for this one.
We are looking at a piece of source material today that completely defies genre expectations. So if you appreciate narratives where the ground just gives way beneath your feet, this deep dive is definitely for you.
For sure.
What we are unpacking today is a breathtaking narrative that reads like a high-speed head-on collision between a gritty, modern true crime thriller, ancient biblical mythology, and like a vivid apocalyptic fever dream.
It is an incredibly dense text. I mean, on the surface, the imagery might seem chaotic, almost hallucinatory.
Yeah, completely unhinged at points.
Right. But when we look closer, we find a meticulously constructed roadmap of the human psyche attempting to survive and really integrate profound trauma.
So our mission today is to decode that roadmap. We're going to examine a text that throws tuxedo-clad kidnappers, military-grade Humvees, and cosmic rivers of gold into the exact same narrative blender.
Which sounds crazy, but it works.
It does. And more importantly, we're going to explore what this aggressive, bizarre clash of symbols tells us about the internal battle between visceral, systemic evil and the restorative, unstoppable power of life.
Grounding ourselves in the beginning of this text is vital because it starts in a place of very fragile recovery.
Yeah, set the scene for us.
So we are introduced to the protagonist, a woman named Elisa. The narrative opens not with a grand cosmic battle, but with her waking up in what the text specifically calls a room of peace.
A room of peace.
Right. She is staring at a picture on a white wall. The picture is of a place called the Tulip Village, and as she looks at it, she feels her body slowly returning to life.
Like a physical thawing out.
Exactly. She literally feels the blood begin to flow warmly in her veins again.
That feeling of slow physical thawing is so universal to anyone who has survived a prolonged period of intense stress.
Yeah, the adrenaline finally leaving the body.
But the narrative doesn't let us rest in that room of peace for long. It immediately slams us into the memory of why she is in that room to begin with.
And this memory establishes the baseline of terror for the entire story.
Right. Elisa was on a mundane jogging path. The kind of completely ordinary setting where, you or I might be listening to an audio track on a Tuesday afternoon.
Total normalcy.
And out of nowhere, black shadows descend on her. She's ambushed and kidnapped by figures the text describes as black angels in tuxedos.
That phrase, black angels in tuxedos, is just a brilliant piece of modern dread.
It really is.
It strips away the gothic supernatural distance we usually associate with dark angels and replaces it with institutional organized menace.
Right, because a tuxedo implies wealth.
Yes, it implies coordination, bureaucracy, and cold, calculated intent. It completely turns a spiritual threat into a corporate one.
So they shove her into a black van, which, I mean, that is the ultimate terrifyingly real-world symbol of abduction.
Absolutely.
The text then reveals their plan, and this is where the bizarre layering really begins. The plan was to sell her to a witch as a human sacrifice,
Right.
while simultaneously trafficking the man she loves, Toivo, to Vladivostok.
The inclusion of Vladivostok is a fascinating anchor.
Yeah, why specifically there?
Well, by placing a human sacrifice to a witch right next to the geopolitical reality of human trafficking to a specific Russian port city, the author violently merges ancient supernatural dread with modern true crime terror.
Wow.
It refuses to let the reader dismiss the danger as a mere fairy tale.
So you are strapping in for the dark underbelly of the real world. As a reader, you are bracing yourself for a gritty geopolitical crime thriller with some dark occult undertones.
You think you understand the rule.
Right. You think you understand the universe this author has built.
Right.
But just as you get your bearings in this grim reality, the narrative violently shifts gears.
Total whiplash.
We transition from the memory of the black man back to the Room of Peace. The door opens. It is Toivo. He is alive.
Yeah.
He enters the room, tears of joy streaming down his face. And he says, "You are okay, my love." They share a reunion kiss. And this simple human gesture completely fractures the reality of the story.
The emotional high of that kiss acts as a catalyst for a cosmic event. The X-ray machine of standard narrative logic just shatters.
Breaks completely.
The text describes the forest in the Tulip Village, the very place she had been gazing at in the picture, literally coming alive.
Oh, man.
The birds, the flowers, and the trees begin to create a beautiful humming melody. Angels appear in the sky singing, and a supernatural, overwhelming light washes over the entire village.
The villagers begin a joyous, ecstatic dance, celebrating their victory over the witch who had terrorized them. And my absolute favorite detail.
The river.
Yes. The river flowing through the center of the village begins to sparkle, suddenly filled with bright golden nuggets shining beneath the water's surface.
It is a vision of an absolute, uncorrupted Eden.
It is. But, yeah. I mean, I have to push back on the author's choices here. As a reader, the tonal whiplash is enough to snap your neck.
Oh, for sure.
Going from human trafficking in a black van straight to singing flowers and a river full of gold nuggets on the very next page, it feels like two completely different writers fighting over the keyboard. Why pivot so fast?
That's a fair question.
Like, why not a slow, realistic depiction of trauma recovery?
Well, the jarring nature of that transition is precisely the mechanism the author uses to communicate the internal reality of the characters.
Okay, how so?
Think about the nature of the dark elements we just discussed. The black van, the tuxedos, Vladivostok. They represent trauma that is mechanical, cold, and indifferent.
Right.
When a human being escapes a threat, that absolute, simple, quiet afternoon doesn't accurately represent the internal emotional explosion of relief.
Oh, I see. The contrast makes the relief palpable.
Yeah.
Like stepping out of a freezing, brutal blizzard directly into a cedar sauna.
Exactly.
The heat only feels that miraculous because of the frostbite you just escaped.
Furthermore, the modern elements, the van and the tuxedos, anchor the fantasy that follows. If the entire story took place in a magical forest, the threat of the witch wouldn't feel visceral to us.
It would lack teeth.
Exactly. But because the threat involves human trafficking, a reality we recognize from the evening news, the terror becomes immediate.
So the salvation has to match the scale of the threat.
Consequently, the resulting salvation cannot just be a return to normal life. To counteract a threat that dark and aggressively real, the salvation has to be overwhelmingly miraculous.
That makes profound sense. The singing angels and the golden river are the proportional psychological response to the black van.
Yes.
It asks you, the listener, to consider how contrasts shape your own life. We only deeply comprehend the profound sanctuary of a true safe space when we understand the severity of the elements outside it.
We need the dark to see the light.
The light is blinding, precisely because we are just suffocating in pitch black. But what makes this text elevate from a simple fairy tale into a complex psychological map is what happens next.
Right. The narrative doesn't just let them off the hook.
No. It doesn't just let Elisa and Toivo dance in the Golden River and roll the end credits. It understands that trauma leaves a blueprint.
Recovery is rarely a linear ascension into permanent joy. Even in the ultimate safe space, the architecture of what you survived remains in the background.
Yeah.
The text illustrates this by abruptly pulling us into what is undeniably its most chilling sequence.
Right in the middle of this beautiful, joyous festival, without any warning, the spirit carries Elisa and Toivo high into the air.
Just yanks them out.
Exactly. They are yanked out of their paradise and forced to look down upon a different kind of forest. The text describes trees that are as gloomy as death itself, and they are oozing a thick black sap.
So visceral.
And the focal point of this nightmare, sitting dead center in this dying forest, is a massive black cube temple.
The anatomy of this vision demands careful attention. This isn't just a spooky haunted house. The black sap from those gloomy trees is flowing directly into the black cube, acting as veins.
It is feeding the structure.
Yeah.
And inside this black cube, there are human bones and skulls piled up. In the center, lying inside a pentagram, is a black stone.
Right.
Hovering around the stone are black-robed angels of darkness making horrific sounds. And the stone itself is glowing with a deuce light, actively communicating with these dark angels.
What the author is doing here is profound. They are visualizing systemic evil not as an abstract concept, but as an infrastructure.
That is exactly what struck me. The bureaucracy of it. It isn't just a monster hiding in the woods. It is a machine.
A very organized machine.
A corporate machine of darkness.
Yeah.
Echoing the tuxedos from the ambush. It uses the black sap as a lifeblood to feed a structure built literally out of the remnants of death, the bones.
Yeah.
The communicating stone shows us that this evil is an active, networked intelligence.
And that networked intelligence is a perfect metaphor for how neurological trauma actually functions in the human brain.
Oh, wow.
Think about the neuroscience of extreme anxiety or PTSD. It isn't just a fleeting bad memory. Trauma physically alters the brain, building entrenched neural pathways.
It creates a literal infrastructure in your head.
Exactly. It creates an infrastructure. The black sap represents the stress hormones, the cortisol and adrenaline, feeding those entrenched pathways.
Pan.
The black cube is the physical structure of fear built in the mind, constantly communicating, constantly buzzing with that dark, anxious energy.
But I have to ask about the timing.
Elisa
and Toivo are at their victory party. They just escaped the black van. Why does the narrative force them to look at the black cube now?
It seems like bad timing.
It feels almost cruel to the characters. Why ruin the festival?
It feels cruel, but it is necessary for true integration. The vision serves as a stark reminder that surviving one battle or escaping one specific black van does not mean the overarching infrastructure of evil.
Or the neural pathways.
Right, where the deeply entrenched neural pathways of trauma have been instantly dismantled. The system is still out there, humming and feeding on decay. The text is demanding that they look at the reality of the world.
And the way they react to seeing this reality is the crux of the entire sequence. Toivo jolts awake from the vision, visibly disturbed and sweating.
Which is a totally normal reaction.
He's reacting the way any of us would. But Lizisa's reaction is staggering. She looks at Toivo, she smiles gently, and she simply invites him to go back to the dance at the village festival.
She integrates the knowledge of the black cube without letting it paralyze her.
It is the ultimate display of psychological fortitude.
Yeah.
She is essentially saying, I know the black cube exists.
Yeah.
I know the machine is humming. Now let's dance.
Yeah.
It reminds me of acceptance and commitment therapy. You don't try to magically erase the anxiety or pretend the trauma didn't happen.
Because you can't.
Right. You acknowledge the structure is there, but you actively choose to engage with the present moment and your own values anyway.
Exactly. Refusing to let the awareness of the black cube ruin the Tula village is an act of profound rebellion against the infrastructure of fear.
Consider how you visualize systemic issues or lingering anxieties in your own life. Whether it is the overwhelming terror of the global news cycle or deep-rooted personal fears about failure or loss.
They loom so large.
They often feel exactly like that black cube, a deep-rooted structure fed by negativity, an active network of worry taking up real estate in your mind.
Yeah.
The challenge the text poses is, how do we acknowledge those structures exist without surrendering our current joy to them?
To maintain that kind of joyous rebellion against a deeply rooted, ancient, networked evil requires more than just willpower. It requires an upgrade in their spiritual and psychological armor.
Which brings us to the next movement of the text.
Right, where the characters embark on an incredibly bizarre journey to acquire that armor.
And this journey violently blends the ancient and the modern once again. They're at the festival, and a character simply named Angel Face appears.
Just Angel Face.
Yeah, Angel Face. And he says, come, I will take you to the holy tree. You need one more thing to fully recover.
Okay, so a quest to a holy tree.
Right, so they need to travel to an ancient holy tree. You would expect them to walk barefoot through a mystical mist, right?
Like Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. Instead, a character named John pulls up to the festival in a white Humvee.
Humvee. The jarring injection of modern military hardware into a mystical quest.
It is wild. They pile into this white Humvee and drive off-road through the forest until they reach a clearing filled with delicate white wood anemones.
The visuals are so striking.
In the center of this clearing is a crystal clear spring pond, and rising from the water is a majestic tree reaching toward the heavens, the biblical tree of life.
Right.
But the guardian of this ancient tree isn't an archangel. It is a Native American man named Charlie. Charlie calls out to them, and to cross the fish-filled spring to the tree, he rows them over in a white kayak.
We should note the accumulation of white objects here.
Yeah, the Humvee, the anemones, the kayak.
It is a deliberate purification of the imagery as they move away from the black cube and approach the center of life.
So they arrive at the tree, and hanging from its branches are these vibrant orange-red fruits. And in a touch of almost like comical practicality, there is a literal wooden sign next to the fruit.
A sign.
A sign that reads, "You must eat so that eternal life may be carried in your heart."
It's very direct.
Toivo eats this heavenly and harmonious fruit, and it triggers a vision that acts as the polar opposite to the nightmare of the black cube.
Right, a fire angel grabs him and lifts him at the speed of lightning into the heavenly realms. He is shown a sprawling green stone forest, and standing in the center of it is his father, Harry.
And Harry is completely restored. He is full of life, and he is dressed in a glowing emerald green suit.
The emerald green suit.
After Toivo witnesses this restoration, the sequence wraps up with a bizarre formal ceremony back in the spring. Angel Face, John the Humvee Driver, and Charlie the Kayak Guardian are all sworn in as Knights of the Tree of Life.
Wow.
They draw these pearl-handled swords that literally spark with light, all while a smiling Messiah figure appears in the water to oversee the knighting.
The color shift from the gloomy black sap through the purifying white of the vehicles and flowers, arriving at the vibrant emerald green of the father's suit, is a beautifully constructed visual arc of returning vitality.
The color arc is beautiful, sure,
yeah.
But I have to stop and challenge the sheer absurdity of the elements involved here.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
We have the ancient biblical tree of life. We have a Native American guardian. We have a guy named John driving a military Humvee. We have a plastic white kayak.
It's a lot.
And then they all get knighted with sparking pearl-handled swords by a smiling Messiah. It feels like a cheap, chaotic pop culture mashup.
Mm.
Like someone took a blender to world mythologies and a modern sporting goods catalog.
I get that criticism.
Convince me this isn't just fundamentally bad writing that ruins the sanctity of the myth.
It only appears chaotic if we demand our mythology to remain static and locked in antiquity. What the author is doing here is practicing radical syncretism.
Radical syncretism.
They are fundamentally refusing to trap the divine or the mechanics of deep psychological healing in the ancient past.
You mean by bringing the Humvee into this sacred space?
Precisely. If the Tree of Life is only accessible via ancient prophets and sandals, it subconsciously tells the modern reader that this level of healing belongs to a different era.
Like it's not available to us now.
Right. It distances the power. By incorporating a Humvee right alongside pearl-handled swords and a Native American guardian, the text insists that spiritual realities and the fight for healing are active in the contemporary world. The Humvee isn't a mistake. It is a statement about modern, active spiritual warfare. It says the divine utilizes whatever modern tools are necessary to navigate the terrain of contemporary trauma.
That reframes the entire sequence for me. It's less of a chaotic mashup and more of an honest reflection of how we actually build our psychological armor.
Exactly.
None of us live in a pure, single mythology world. When we face our own deeply rooted traumas, we pull from a wild mix of sources to survive.
Whatever works.
We might use a concept from modern cognitive therapy, combined with a piece of wisdom from our grandparents, anchored by a metaphor we heard in a pop culture movie. We use whatever psychological Humvees and kayaks get us across the dark water.
We cobble together our own unique knighthood to protect our mental sanctuaries, and that knighthood is framed around an act of duty.
Right.
They aren't just given the fruit so they can relax. They are given sparking swords. They are armed to protect innocence.
And they're going to need every ounce of that militant grace.
Yeah.
Because the source material is about to introduce the orchestrator behind the black cube, the architect of the terror.
Here we go.
And this villain, Nimrod, is crafted with a visceral grotesqueness that absolutely defies description.
The introduction of Nimrod is a masterclass in evoking physical revulsion to communicate spiritual decay.
The text cuts to him, and he is deeply, deeply unsettling. He's a red face.
Yeah.
But the text clarifies he isn't just flushed with anger. His face is literally blood red because he is in the middle of eating an innocent deer alive.
It's so dark.
He wears a crown constructed entirely out of human finger bones. His clothing is crafted from the scales of fish and lizards. He sits on a throne made of bone and human skin.
Every single element surrounding him, everything he wears or consumes, is extracted from another living creature.
And he has pitch black eyes. But what fascinated me the most is what he is actually doing in his rotting black tower. He isn't plotting a brilliant military strategy.
No, he's not.
He is sitting there using a round, dark glass connected to a network of possessed ravens to spy on the Whitehearts.
Mm.
He's just watching Elisa, Toivo, and the villagers in the Tulip Village.
Like a voyeur.
And when he sees their glowing temple and their joy, he doesn't launch an attack. He just screams in agonizing pain. He spits acid onto the floor of his own tower.
Spitting acid on his own floor.
He commands his hovering black-hooded creatures in a frenzy, and he just howls like a wolf from the top of his rotting fortress.
The contrast between Nimrod and the Tree of Life is the thematic core of the entire text. Look at the Tree of Life. It freely offers its orange-red fruit.
Yeah, there's literally a sign offering it.
The sign literally begs the traveler to eat and take eternal life. It is entirely generative. It produces life from within itself. Nimrod, on the other hand, is the ultimate embodiment of consumption and extraction.
He's just a parasite.
He creates nothing. His crown is stolen bones, his throne is stolen skin, his food is stolen life.
He is a black hole. And what strikes me about his evil is how fundamentally unoriginal and pathetic it is. The spitting of the acid onto his own floor is such a raw depiction of self-destruction.
It is.
He is furious that other people are capable of joy, and that fury is physically eroding his own environment.
His agonizing screams and his voyeuristic spying through the dark glass show us that evil, in the worldview of this narrative, is inherently miserable. It is entirely reactive.
Right.
He cannot generate his own light, so he is reduced to howling at the light of others from isolation.
If we pull Nimrod out of this apocalyptic fantasy and drop him into everyday human psychology, it is the most perfect metaphor for toxic envy and narcissism I have ever seen.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about people who are entirely consumed by jealousy or hatred. They don't build their own joy. They sit in their metaphorical towers, scrolling through dark glass screens, spying on the happiness of others.
Just doom scrolling and fuming.
And that envy eats them from the inside out, exactly like acid spitting onto the floor. They become the king of a bone throne, but they are utterly, miserably alone.
They trap themselves in a rotting tower of their own making.
So we have Nimrod howling his wolf-like howl, seething with his pathetic reactive hatred. The tension is stretched to its absolute limit. Nimrod's howling reaches a crescendo, setting up the grand finale.
It's building to a breaking point.
But the narrative is about to unleash an apocalyptic response that turns standard fantasy warfare completely on its head.
The heavens finally break into the corrupted space, but the resolution is wildly unexpected.
Picture the sky over this rotting, acid-stained tower. Suddenly, the clouds tear open with a blinding flash of lightning. Riding above the storm on a white horse is Jesus, wearing a robe dipped in blood.
Classic imagery.
This is classic, grandiose Book of Revelation imagery. As a reader, you are bracing for the ultimate divine smiting. You expect the rider on the white horse to draw a flaming sword, dive down, and personally obliterate Nimrod.
That's what you want to see.
But instead, the rider pauses. He looks down and he delegates.
He defers the victory.
He looks down and says, "Come, Harry, this is your specialty."
Harry.
Harry, the Father Toivo, saw restored in the emerald green suit during his vision at the Tree of Life. And what happens next is the most glorious, unhinged climax imaginable.
It really is.
A massive golden river of life bursts directly from heaven. It crashes into Nimrod's tower and immediately begins to melt the stone. And riding the rushing current of this cosmic golden river surfing on a white log is Toivo's father, Harry.
And he brings an incredibly specific tool to this battle.
He is holding a golden sickle. While surfing a white log down a heavenly river, Harry hurls the golden sickle with massive force.
Just chucks it.
It spins through the air and slices the Lord of Darkness cleanly in half. It is instantaneous. Nimrod, his melting castle, and a specific group of minions the text calls the Harry pulsating demons of fear are all swept up by the golden river.
A total wash.
A deep chasm opens in the earth, swallowing them forever as the creatures scream. A heavenly song echoes across the sky, declaring, "Evil is swallowed for eternity. Now the saints shall rule."
It is a breathtaking, overwhelming avalanche of life extinguishing death.
But again, I have to challenge the mechanics of this victory. Of all the ways the author could have ended this epic battle, the supreme being tags in a guy named Harry to surf a log down a river and chuck a farming tool at the devil.
Yeah, it's definitely a choice.
It borders on the absurd. Why this bizarre lumberjack-style takedown instead of just striking Nimrod with lightning?
The absurdity masks a deep thematic resonance. The author is making a profound statement about the nature of redemption. By delegating the final blow to Harry, the text argues that the redemption of trauma is a deeply personal, familial, and human endeavor.
This is your specialty. It is a father defending his bloodline.
Exactly. The divine provides the power, the golden river, but the ultimate victory requires human agency. Harry striking the blow against the darkness that orchestrated the kidnapping of his son implies the healing of generational trauma.
Oh, wow.
The vision Toivo had at the Tree of Life was a prerequisite. He had to see his father's vitality restored before the father could act as the instrument of their deliverance.
And the choice of the weapon, the golden sickle. Why a sickle?
Well, a sickle is an agricultural tool. It is fundamentally designed for harvesting, not for warfare. A sword is designed to kill. A sickle is designed to reap what has been sown, to clear the old growth, to make way for the new harvest.
Right.
Harry isn't engaging in a brutal, exhausting duel. The golden river melting the tower demonstrates that the sheer presence of abundant life dissolves decay effortlessly. The sickle is just the final necessary harvest of the corruption.
That completely changes how I view the climax. It isn't a war, it's a harvest. And the detail about what exactly gets washed away is the final puzzle piece.
The demon.
The text explicitly points out the hairy, pulsating demons of fear. Nimrod, with all his bone crowns and his acid in his rotting tower, wasn't the lord of pride or greed. He was ultimately just the lord of pure visceral fear.
And fear cannot withstand the relentless, flowing current of life.
The entire story, stripped of its magical realism, is a psychological blueprint for overcoming the paralyzing grip of terror.
Which speaks volumes about personal empowerment for anyone listening. This narrative, as chaotic and surreal as it is, suggests that overcoming our grandest evils or our most entrenched personal traumas isn't about waiting passively for a lightning bolt to rescue us.
No.
We are given the tools, the golden river, the support of our ancestors, the psychological Humvees, but we have to take the shot ourselves. Our healing requires an active, militant grace. We have to hurl the sickle.
We must become active participants in our own deliverance. What a staggering, exhausting, and beautiful journey this text has taken us on to arrive at that point.
It's been a ride.
We started in the terrifying, grounded reality of a mundane jogging path, ambushed by black angels in tuxedos, facing the cold reality of a black van in Vladivostok. We were thrown into the tonal whiplash of the Tulip Village, where the relief of survival made the forests sing and the rivers fill with golden nuggets.
We confronted the neuroscience of trauma made physical, the chilling, networked infrastructure of the black cube, fed by the oozing black sap of our own anxieties.
We took a literal military Humvee ride with a Native American guardian in a kayak to eat fruit from the ancient Tree of Life, proving that we must pull from every corner of our modern and ancient world to build our psychological armor.
We witnessed the pathetic, self-destructive nature of toxic envy as Nimrod spit acid onto the floor of his isolated, rotting tower.
And we ended with a log-surfing father, wielding the tools of harvest, slicing through the ultimate embodiment of fear and a rushing golden river. It's a story that utilizes every color in the palette and every genre available to map out the brutal geography of human trauma and the aggressive, vibrant nature of healing.
It leaves us with the profound realization that while the architecture of trauma might be dark, highly organized, and deeply entrenched, the infrastructure of life is older, stronger, and infinitely more creative.
Which brings us to the final thread I want you to pull on as we conclude this deep dive. Think back to our discussion about the climax. The text strips away all of Nimrod's terrifying facade and identifies his minions simply as the demons of fear. Fear was the root of the entire corruption.
Everything else was just dressing.
Right. So if all the monstrous visceral imagery we just explored, the gloomy trees oozing black sap, the bone throne, the acid spitting, the rotting tower, were ultimately just physical manifestations of pure fear, what does the golden river of life represent in your own daily internal battles?
That's the question.
We all have those x-rays of our minds that look terrifyingly muddy. We all have moments where we are yanked from our peaceful moments and forced to look at the humming machinery of our own black cubes. But in the face of those entrenched anxieties, in the shadow of the rotting towers you might build in your own mind, what does your personal golden sickle look like? I invite you to step away today and figure out what tool you need to harvest that fear and how you can actively choose to let the river of life melt the tower.